You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Hello, National Security Law Today podcast listeners, and thanks again for joining us. I'm Holly McMahon, director of our Standing Committee on Law and National Security. Well, it's springtime, which means graduation. Before we begin, first I want to congratulate those who are graduating, but before we begin the podcast today, I want to mention two opportunities within our committee. First, we have a new position opening on our staff in the DC office, Program Specialist. The full-time job description can be found on our website, but if you find these topics of interest, and who doesn't, this is a great opportunity to quickly immerse yourself in this fast-paced environment, collaborating with a community of intelligence and national security professionals, where you'll have the opportunity to engage in both an in-person and hybrid work setting. Come join us. Well, and now that graduation season is here, you might know someone who is just starting out or thinking about law school down the road or work in the national security arena. This is a great opportunity. Please send your resume and bio to me, Holly McMahon, holly.mcmahon@americanbar.org. But act fast. We also have some openings for unpaid summer internships in the DC office. Check out our website. We're looking for 1L or 2Ls. Come join us and see what national security law is really all about. Now over to our podcast.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the ABA's Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet. Thanks for listening. All right now, we can see the failure to heed warnings about national security that science fiction gave us decades ago. Extreme privatization of services intended to protect Americans. Tax reductions that at least initially seem helpful, but ultimately could result in things like people having to pay for police services. We're going to continue our series on science fiction today and the cautionary tales for national security that can be found in those novels. And my guests today, you heard that right, plural. It wasn't just some sort of weird lisp that I've acquired since the last podcast. Are Harvey Ryshikoff, who is the former chair of the Standing Committee of the ABA. And Mr. Ryshikoff, there's nothing he hasn't done in Washington, from providing counsel to the FBI, to government leaders elsewhere, to the judiciary branch, if you want to be fair. And Tracy Reynolds, who's a commander in the U.S. Navy and co-chair of the Space Law Interest Group with the American Society of International Law. And I would add, caveat, both Tracy and I are here only in our individual capacities, and we don't speak on behalf of any agency or firm. It's good to have you both here. Thanks.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Wonderful.
All right. We've got two books on deck today. The first one is, I'm going to butcher this again, but it's Liu Cixin.
Liu Cixin.
Cixin. Got it. Okay. The Three Body Problem. And then Octavia Butler's second installment, which was The Parable of the Talents. All right, Harvey, I know you were influenced by The Three Body Problem. I thought it was a big deal, too. Tell us what it's about for those people who've never heard of it.
Well, it's not easily summarized, but as we have Tracy with us, I would say that it's a preoccupation that many of us have, which is the existence of extraterrestrial species beings. And the premise of the book is that there are extraterrestrial species beings out there, and that these species beings are more technologically sophisticated than we are. And the story weaves through a fascinating tale because it begins with the Cultural Revolution, in which a young girl who ends up to become and grow up to be an extraordinary scientist witnesses the beating and killing of her father, who also is a scientist. And she goes on to join the Red Army. And what her job eventually in the Red Army is to be part of a radio entity that is beaming messages out to the universe to see if there is other life. And lo and behold, a message comes back to her that there is other life. But the message also says, do not continue the communications because it may prove to be dangerous. But she is so dissatisfied with the China that she is living in, she actually starts the communication process and then unfolds into the extraordinary long-term relationship of a group of individuals who are so chosen to understand that there are communications going on of this nature. In the book, it's the first of a series. The other two books are The Dark Forest and Death's End. And those books in the Netflix series, it ends with sort of the end of book one, but Elizabeth was saying that she didn't like it because they condensed the three books into the first book. So if you read the book, you're a little bit upset because things start jumping around in the Netflix series. But I nonetheless recommend it because of the extraordinary issues that it raises that I think we all should be thinking about, which is A, the dystopia world that we live in. B, are there superior beings living out there in the galaxy? And when we contact them, what will happen with the interaction? I think that's sort of an issue that national security experts and Tracy's expertise, those who believe in space exploration and space as being one of the never-ending science fiction questions that we wrestle with.
Okay, well, that leads next to, so that's the theme that you see, the national security theme that you see through the book, which is anticipating the possibility, even likelihood, that we're not alone. And what are we going to do with that, right? That it couldn't just be one solar system with a perfectly placed planet from a sun. But Tracy, this is sort of something that you're terribly interested in, probably more than the average bear. What do you think are the main national security themes you see running through this just amazing work of fiction?
Thank you for the opportunity to be here with you both. This is just such an exciting pleasure. And these books, as a triad, as a trilogy, are fascinating because what they really seem to be showing us is that what will happen or what could potentially happen if we are contacted by alien lives. Because the Western trope seems to be, oh, we will come together as a globe and we will rise to the best version of Western version of humanity and we will go out and overcome. I don't know about you, but we watch Independence Day every 4th of July in my family. I mean, it is a tradition. But here we have the three body problem. And the invitation is, we can't solve our own problems. Come here and solve the Earth for us. And that's was shocking to me as a reader because it was so contrary to the science fiction and fantasy worldview that I grew into, you know, as a young child. And then as I've continued to develop, and I will have to say here that David Benioff and D.B. Weiss have hurt me before because I am a George R.R. Martin fan and was very excited about Game of Thrones on HBO. So it was with great trepidation that I started watching The Three Body Problem on Netflix. And some of those failures are definitely there for me. So, Elisa, I feel you on that. But I do think it was genius the way they collapsed those three books, because the three books are really what happens. There will be folks that welcome our new technologically advanced overlords. There will be people that go off into the great beyond and pledge to fight another day for 1,000 years. And there will be people that will worship our new alien ruling class as gods. And it was really interesting to see it divided up that way. And then again, to see it smushed down into one, I kind of had to abandon keeping track of any of the characters for me, because my mind kept trying to put the story from the books over the Netflix show. So I had to just divorce those completely and just think, okay, I'm just going to enjoy this for what it is. And after I got over being a little angry at Benioff and Weiss, still mad, by the way, because I think there's a lot of things that happen in the three-body Netflix show. They're unnecessary and hogwashy, a la ruining my sweet Khaleesi. But, you know, that's a conversation for another day. But those are really the themes that jump out at me, is that this Pollyanna approach of humanity will join together and rise up as one to have a human species that comes up into first contact with an aggressive, technologically advanced species and triumph. I mean, that is not what you're going to find in the three-body problem.
No, and it's frankly unrealistic. But you sort of said these are the themes. And I mean, are they distinct from the cautionary tales? What would we take from these and maybe think about with respect to our own national security? What did they warn about?
I think a major takeaway is the understanding that even in instances of intense cooperation, individual nation states and entities outside of nation states will continue to advocate for what that entity thinks is best for them, whether it's a company, whether it's an actual country, whether it is a non-governmental entity, be an IGO, NGO, or some other manifestation. I think that's something that it also has in common with Octavia Butler's works, in the sense that you see entities leaning into perceived gaps to fill that up with actions, policies, laws, and procedures that benefit them. And that's something that we can't be ignorant to. I am an optimist, as I said, but I'm a realist too. And we have to be aware of people's words and state government's words, but we have to watch what individuals and entities are doing. Because in the Navy, we say the say-do gap. What is the gap between what you're saying and what you're doing? So that I'm fully aware of that 360 view so that I can make the best choices, you know, for my interests as well.
Oh, I sort of concurring with that statement is that first, we, you know, there's a great phrase from Durkheim, self-interest properly understood. This idea of truly understanding one's self-interest and not having the other famous phrase of the 19th century theoretician, false consciousness, is something that has played humanity since its inception. Since we've understood power and the desire to dominate, which is basically the lesson of history, and the incapacity we've had to create transnational organizations that actually deal with the problems that are greater than the nation state, e.g. global warming, the book gives the perspective that that will continue. Despite the fact there is a common enemy that is threatening the globe, as you're saying, Tracy, the inability to coordinate our actions for a greater good and the greater community have eluded us and have continued to elude us. And the second element, which is quite fascinating, which is reminds me of, if you remember, one of the issues is the aliens describing us as bugs. That usually aggravates people, but it kind of, for those of us of the literary sort, remember Camus' The Plague, in which the ending is, and the plague is the issue of dehumanizing individuals and seeing the plague as treating people as bugs. And the dehumanizing we have seen repeatedly in our world history that has resulted in forms of Holocaust that have terrified us. But we as a species being seem to be able to dehumanize each other, not see ourselves as humans, see as something less than humans, lower than humans, which then allows us to alienate them. And in the book, one of the other interesting elements of the superior being is when the film translates that as they become very upset with the idea that we live for deception, that humans can, do, and will deceive. And that's not the Boy Scout world that we were socialized into as young'uns. And that issue of deception is one of the reasons is why are we worthy to survive as a species, if that is what we do to each other.
Well, it was interesting to me too, to this comment that you just made, Harvey, about not being able to come together. And I would raise that actually and argue that we chose to work in opposition to each other, not even being able to agree on the end goal. I was really just kind of mind blown by the concept of the character in the very beginning, Yanzi, who talks about, you know, how she's inviting the superior technological race to come to Earth. Like she was, will help in our own destruction. I mean, you can't have a meeting of the minds type of conversation with someone who's so diametrically opposed with your own goals, you know, because that's destruction. You know, whether, you know, when I read The Three-Body Problem, I didn't see it the way the show showed it, with her wanting the Trisolarans to come so that they could fix the earth. I didn't read the book that way. So for me, like one of the
I didn't either. I didn't see that.
Like page 16, there's a in my Kindle, which is, you know, probably not the right page, but one of the quotes was, "In China, any idea that dared to take flight would only crash back to the ground. The gravity of reality is too strong." And I raise that because no one could escape the gravity of her thoughts and her choice. I mean, it was a black hole that sucked humanity into destruction. I mean, at least that was my view on it in that very beginning. It's like we can't, it's not even that we're capable of treating each other well. It's that we can't even have a conversation about what the humanity's end goal should be because we're so diametrically opposed. And the bug piece, I love that you brought that up because to me, it was all a very Kafka metamorphosis type of comment that had that horrific duality of taking sentient life and making it into something worthless to be crushed. And as you so rightly pointed out, Harvey, we've done that humans to humans, I think for as long as we've been around. I think Neanderthals and Homo sapiens were doing that. And we've only
The other is the past.
I think for the family fathers, that was the origin of political parties. So I think the there's two things that stem from that.
The bug analogy or
No, the Neanderthals taking over. They didn't see factions, but two points. One, your quote also can be read. Because don't forget, this is a Chinese author.
Yes.
This is a Chinese author dealing with an extraordinary state, a mega state of censorship. Mm. And that perception of ideas have to be controlled very much is the authoritarian regime's understanding of how it deals with different ideas and concepts. In that context, as you read. And two, the other thing which I find very charming is the concept that don't worry, technology will save us.
That's going to work. AI is going to be great. AI derived from Twitter is going to be save us.
That AI will prove to be better. And I'm involved in a number of DARPA projects in which, when we explain to certain professional groups, e.g., doctors, that a form of AI and algorithm may be superior to their ability to do a diagnosis and make a recommendation. For some reason, they're not happy about this.
Yeah, shocking, right? You know, we're going to talk about that at ASL in a few weeks in May, because the whole AI for androids, outer space, all of that nexus, we've had such a good opportunity in science fiction narratives to parse through that. But the Tracy Reynolds approach is, do we really even need programmers? Maybe we need to get some parents. You know, because we have lots of data, but the difficulty is, how do you want this AI to grow up? Do you want it to be the entity that's inviting the advanced technological species to come and colonize Earth? Just one other point of context about that quote. I wanted to make it clear that that was her father. That was one of his thoughts as he's being beaten to death on a stage in front of, you know, screaming students and his own daughter and his wife. That was one of his thoughts. And that was part of why I found it to be so powerful.
The idea that the rational is superior. I always love teaching science and technology undergraduates because they actually believe there's a correct answer. They come from the concept there's only a finite number of ways to build a bridge. And if you're wrong, it collapses. Ergo, there has to be certain answers that are right within a range. And when you explain to them that we have competing values in the law, example, the latest Supreme Court decision concerning what does it mean to have the president have immunity and how far does it extend and what the possible consequences are. We're in a whole different world of reasoning. In the world of AI, in the world that we live in, it's all rational. And your phrase, sentient being, like, what is that? Like, what makes one a sentient being?
I would love to have a conversation about that.
You have to be above a bug.
Well, personhood under the law has changed a lot there was not that long ago that I couldn't have a credit card without my husband's signature on the document. It was not that long ago that people of different ethnicities or colors were not viewed as people under the law. Will we even be able to recognize when AI has achieved the point where it should have legal personhood? There are some cultures that have ascribed legal personhood to bodies of water, to mountains. The Navajo Nation sees the moon, a celestial body that's governed, you know, by an international treaty regime, as a sacred object. So there's a lot of cultural differences associated with what legal personhood should be. And I think feelings are important. And I think emotions are important. And I think logic is important. But if you ask me which one is more important, I'm going to ask you what problem you're trying to solve first.
Okay, guys, let's wrap up. Let me just say this historically, just for our listeners, the Chinese Communist Party banned science fiction writing as capitalistic. And they did this for almost a decade, from 1966 to 1976. I forget when you refer to the beating scene, but for our listeners who may not know, the father of the scientist was beaten because he was a scientist, because he believed in science. And that was deemed not sort of the working man's thing, I guess, during that period. The author himself is a computer scientist as well as a writer. And apparently, just so you understand a little bit of what his life must have been like and how this comes out in the book, his father kept science fiction books under the bed because during the Cultural Revolution, of course, they were not allowed. But those books that influenced him were written by H.G. Wells, Jules Verne, and a couple of other authors. But that beating scene that we think of as occurring at the beginning of the book, he had to bury. And this is modernly, because this book wasn't written that long ago. I forget the exact year of publication, but he had to bury that scene in the middle of the book. And it wasn't until after he got approval to publish it that his editor moved it to the front. And he also changed the character of the scientist. Originally, he had written that as a man, but he decided there was insufficient gender balance in the book. And when he went and changed it, created that character as a woman, he really had to change nothing, he said. It was just very fluid and already part of the book. So I thought that was a very interesting thing. Other people who've talked about the cautionary tales have highlighted, well, I think I was talking, you know, before we started recording, Harvey, I think one of the more interesting features of the discussion between the nations as the aliens is coming is the value of a back channel. Harvey, it's obvious to us, but to somebody who's never heard that before, why don't you say what a back channel is and why it has a value in national security?
Well, the book was published in 2008 is the date. And then I think it comes in 2014 in English. Well, the back channel is critical in most diplomacy. I will take the issue of what's going on today in Israel and Hamas and the Palestinians. There clearly are back channels and discussions taking place with third parties and the Saudis as to being able to resolve the question of the Israeli hostages and the idea of what type of secession of projection of force by the Israelis into the West Bank. And you need to be able to have conversations that are not public, in which individuals are willing to, in the back channel, present what they think are possible positions that can then be moved into the higher level of the table of negotiations. We sometimes call them 1.5 talks. I've been involved with a number of them with the Chinese and the Russians over different years of different issues. And the back channel is a senior official can signal to another senior official something that could and should be raised at the high table, because the moment has come in which there may be a resolution. So the back channel, I think, has always been a critical element of diplomacy since the Old Testament.
So the other thing is that we had on at some point a guy who had retired. He'd been the station chief in Moscow a couple of times. He's been on our podcast twice. And his greatest concern regarding Ukraine and Russia was when the back channels weren't functioning. He really felt that, you know, you could sit down and just be really blunt. He can just look and say, look, Yuri, and they can have an open conversation. And that back channel was a feature that recurred or came toward the end of the book. But it's an interesting thing. And it's not always obvious, I think, when you first detect what's happening in three body problem. All right. Here's what's actually going on in the world, folks. And it doesn't involve us squabbling. So it looks like Russia has continued to infiltrate Europe's institutions. We're learning more this week, including Putin's favorite targets, which include the European Economic Union, or the EU, as well as NATO. So Germany has now arrested two men who were planning to bomb industrial and military sites in Germany. Their motive was to disrupt aid to Ukraine and assist Russia through their crimes. And among the two targets the two scouted were, long pause, U.S. military bases, including those in Bavaria. This happened a month after Germans arrested a senior officer in the German defense ministry who was passing secret equipment procurement plans to Russia, and a politician with Germany's far-right Alternative for Germany party, which apparently is just second in the polls even as we speak, was found to have taken money from Russia's main pro-Kremlin oligarchs. And that was used to spread, that money, purpose of it was so that he would spread pro-Russia propaganda. So pause right here to say, we've talked a lot about how certain members of Congress, including Fish from Iowa in the run-up to World War II, were spreading pro-Nazi propaganda. You know, the results for those people were criminal convictions, right? And it's not been so long ago, let me point out, that Germany's Wirecard COO, and this was a big financial operation, fled to Moscow after he was discovered to have been spying for the Kremlin and probably sending money there. He's hiding right now, apparently, dressed as an Orthodox priest. And even more recently, a Russian influence operation was discovered once again inside of the EU itself. And that one was intended to affect the vote by the bloc, which is set for June. So thoughts?
I'm not surprised. Did I know any of that before you said it? No.
Then that works. That response works. I like that.
But I'm just saying that because it's not like I am coming to some deep insight here, and because I'm so well read in current events, because I've got four kids, two cats, two dogs, and a darling loving husband, and my ability to know what's happening around me is sometimes limited.
So, I feel your pain.
But when I hear that, though, I'm not surprised at all. This, I think, is something kind of straight out of Confucius, if you will. There's a story I heard once years ago about the smart farmer that's trying to grow corn, and he's watering his plants so that they'll grow quickly. And then he gets the wonderful idea that what he's going to do instead is grab them by the top of the leaves and pull so that they can grow more quickly. And so you may be thinking to yourself, Tracy, that's totally illogical, irrelevant, and has nothing to do with anything we just said.
But I cannot say that, though.
If you bear with me for 10 more seconds, that is an important parable because it illustrates foolishness. And what we're seeing are other players in the great power competition plan right now is the opposite of foolishness. We're seeing not this short, myopic window of time for planning for short-term benefits like we see in the parable of talents. We're seeing the culmination and execution of long-term planning strategies, which is a feature of an autocratic regime when you have the same person in charge for a really long time. You know, personally, I have no desire to live in such a regime because for me, the chaos is kind of a feature as well as a bug. And I don't want autocracy. I think that's bad. But you can have a whole of government approach that's above and beyond what the United States government can bring to bear when you don't have our internal staffing and the other bureaucratic institutions that lead to slower decision making and allow for more deviation from common plan. So this doesn't surprise me at all. It sounds exactly like something they would do.
We need to move on to China because retiring commander of, I guess what, the PAC fleet? I don't know. John Aquilino, is accused China of a boiling frog strategy in the Pacific. Now, I'm going to credit this guy. If I had any idea what the hell a boiling frog strategy was, it sounds really...
I grew up on a farm in rural Missouri, and people have been talking about boiling frogs for hundreds of years. So with all due respect to Admiral Aquilino, who I admire and I've not worked directly for, but was in the Indo-PACOM AOR when he was in charge of that water space. He's a very, very smart guy, but he did not come up with a boiling frog.
The boiling frog analogy that I think the commander was alluding to was something we would know legally as adverse possession. That in the adverse possession concept.
That's interesting. I'm going to give you, that is interesting. Harvey Rishikov.
The adverse possession is, even though we perceive the Pacific as our ground or our sovereignty, they are taking actions. And later in the script, you will lay out what the actions is what they're doing, which gives the perception that they see it as their sovereignty.
Well, and the United States does have areas within the Pacific AOR that are under United States sovereignty, like specifically Guam, the Hawaiian Islands. You know, but in general terms, the United States doesn't see the South China Sea as U.S. sovereign area. They see it as falling under customary international law, the law of the sea, which allows for the freedom of navigation of all on that water space that's outside the jurisdiction of any one state. And so the boiling frog is frightening to a lot of folks because the frog has been boiled away to mush and death before it even knows that it's too hot. I mean, if you think about the South China Sea, the Spratly Islands in particular, those are maritime features over which many sovereigns have a claim. So the United States general policy has been to treat them as maritime features entitled to a territorial sea, but have limited to no opinions on to which sovereign a specific feature belongs, all the while balancing the myriad cultural, economic, political, and treaty obligations in that particular area of the world, because it's quite complex. China's approach has been much more clear. This is ours. It's always been ours. It always will be ours. And
yeah, well, yes, apropos of that, so apparently Chinese Coast Guard vessels have been firing water cannons to stop the Philippines from resupplying Marines on the Sierra Madre. I mean, that's apparently an old ship that the Philippines sunk so it could attach to a reef. And that purpose of sinking it, as I understand it, was to protect the Philippines from incursions by sea, principally given that direction from China. So fascinating piece this week, which describes in detail precisely how China spies. Now, we're not endorsing this. It's just that they break it down as a matter of bureaucracy. It's very well laid out in there. Talks about how the Shanghai Bureau targets the U.S. because there are historical, cultural, and commercial ties with the U.S. and Shanghai. The Zhejiang Bureau targets Western Europe. The Tianjin Bureau targets Japan and South Korea. This is a fascinating story. We're going to provide a hyperlink to it just because I think it is really interesting. And what made it interesting to me today was that Musk was meeting with Chinese Premier Li Keqiang. I think it's Keqiang. I guess I'm not sure. Is this good for America? We would hope, but it certainly was good for Tesla stock. And he wants to deliver to China, you know, he wants this contract to have these driverless taxis, right? That are all over, anticipated to be all over China. You know, I had to wonder, of course, was this, you know, in the run-up to the shareholder vote on his outsized compensation package, you know, that was shot down by Delaware Chancery, I guess it was, court, after Tesla's poor stock performance. And he did seem to get what he wanted today. At least that's what I saw in the, what do they call it again, in Parable of the Talents, the news snippet or whatever.
Oh, yes, the news bullets.
Snippet I got.
Yes.
What did you guys think of sort of this whole movement? I mean, just there's so much going on with China right now. I mean, they've found to be spying all over Europe. It's just, and yet, you know, we need to keep those back channels and a dialogue open here. I just wondered how you guys reacted to it. Any given week, there's just so much China hijinks news.
Well, I think it goes back to the long-term strategy. You know, the silly story that I shared is a parable in reverse, right? Because you don't pull on it, you just let it grow, right? Well, China doesn't play the same type of checkers that we play, they play Go. I mean, it's a different type of approach to long-term strategizing that the United States doesn't share. I mean, a 5,000-year seat of heaven type of history up against a six-month FitRip bullet is difficult whenever you're thinking about long-term planning, which is something we've talked about a few times as it relates to short-term versus long-term human decision-making.
And Tracy, I thought of you, by the way, when we've had this conversation before, short-term, long-term. I found in the back of the most recent issue of Foreign Affairs, I don't know if you saw this, Harvey, look at the back. There's an essay written by Nixon, I guess, between when it was clear he was resigning and when he did resign on China. One of the things he cautioned, and by the way, I am not a Nixon fan. You won't find that tattoo on my body. It's just very interesting. For whatever reason, he wanted to talk about, he seemed to express concern. By the way, it wasn't a super piece in terms of how it was written, but his point was, all of our short-term policies with respect to China, we need to think long-term. And now we know, you know, they have 50-year plans and they think long-term, to Tracy's point about what an ancient culture they come from and so on. I just would say, if you haven't seen this, it's one page, it's a reprint, and it's in the very back of Foreign Affairs. Anyway, that's a wrap for today.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policies.